I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have another one of our Yes Conversations. Yes Magazine, in its latest issue, of course, it has their Breakthrough 15, people whose work are changing the dynamics of our world, as they call them, 15 extraordinary people transforming the way we live, each nominated by somebody else who either is part of the Yes family or has read Yes Magazine, or works at Yes Magazine. This particular gentleman we're about to talk to was nominated by David Corton, one of the founders of Yes Magazine and a fascinating economic thinker in his own right. We're about to talk with Jason F. McLennan. And Jason, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So I was really fascinated by this piece about you, and then started reading your website and all these other articles about you and your work, because everyone makes this huge thing of Leeds buildings. You know, we're building Leeds building, and it's like 47 feet tall, and we're building a Leeds house that has 6,000 square feet in it, but it's safe for the environment. And your take on that and your take on what needs to be happening is very different, because you're talking about building things that are certified as living.
That's correct. And we don't mean literally living, but we refer to it as using nature's principles as the true measuring stick for success. And we're big supporters of LEED. We think it's a good program that has moved the industry in substantial way forward. But we think that it, given the environmental issues that we are facing us, that we need to be going much further, much faster. And the Living Building Challenge, which is the program that I run, asks the design and building community to do just that, to go much further and more quickly.
Now, to talk a bit about that in all seriousness, and I wasn't kind of putting down LEED buildings because I think they're important as well, but you there are seven categories, as the Yes piece on you and your work talked about, that can certify a living building or a park or a street or whatever that might be. And those seven categories are sight, water, energy, health, materials, equity, and beauty. Can we go through those and talk about what all that means, like sight?
Sure. Well, we care a great deal about where a building or project is located. We take a fairly hard stance in that we think that our species has co-opted enough land on the planet, and it's time that we focus on rehabilitating and regenerating the sites that we've already co-opted. So we actually don't allow new sites, no more continued urban sprawl, no more building so-called green buildings out in the middle of nowhere that people have to drive long distances to get to.
Mm-hmm.
We really are encouraging infill development, redevelopment of existing properties. This isn't just for new construction. It's really for any type of building and construction. But we really focus people on saying we need to work with what we've already impacted. And, in fact, we need to look at how one completely transforms the relationship of the project to its site, to the specifics of that climate and the ecology surrounding the property, or in many cases the ecology that should be there that is not there any longer. So we take it with any of the categories, we call them petals of our program.
Mm-hmm.
We try to take as holistic a view as possible and really ask again, what does good look like? What is truly successful, and what would fundamentally change the relationship of humanity to the natural world with the way we design and build?
So when you use one of your petals, I was curious about the petal beauty and what that meant, given that can be such a subjective thing. What do you mean by beauty when it's one of your seven petals in terms of certifying a building a living space, or any place a living space?
Sure, and we should go through some of the other petals as well, like energy and water.
Yeah, please do. I'm going to hear about them, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and so when you ask about beauty, it's interesting because one of the things that's important about our work is that we try to take, again, a very holistic view of things, and we try to take a very balanced view in terms of both I would call them right brain issues and left brain issues. And so the program, when we talk about some of the other pedals, contains elements of our program that is left brain, I would say, highly measurable, metric-oriented, performance-based, things like energy and water that you can measure, et cetera. But we recognize that there are a host of other issues that are not so easy to quantify, not so easy to measure. And our society has the tendency to completely discount and not consider issues where we can't measure them. We treat them as if they have no impact or they're zero on a balance sheet. And oftentimes, the things that are hard in life to measure can have a more profound impact on actual performance and environmental impact than the things that are measurable. So our program sits in this very unique space. There's no other green building program that does this anywhere, where we, again, match up things that are completely measurable in a conventional sense, like net zero energy and net zero water. And then we deal with issues such as equity and issues such as beauty and good design, and recognizing that as emotional creatures, which we are, how something is designed, its beauty, its elegance, the thoughtfulness taken to the structure has a huge impact on how the building will be operated, how the building will be maintained through time, whether it will be preserved rather than thrown away and demolished, all of which have significant measurable impacts on the environment themselves. And so we focus on this issue. There's a lot of so-called green buildings that exist that are ugly, that people don't want to be in.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're addressing this idea that it matters, that design matters. And then, you know, people then naturally ask, well, is this a beauty contest? Are you trying to, you know, tell us what you like and what you don't like? And actually, that's not the approach we take at all. We recognize that beauty is, by its nature, as I said, almost impossible to measure. But we care about the intentionality of those involved with the projects around these issues. And so we actually ask the designers of the projects, the owners of the projects, and the occupants, sort of the three key folks that are involved with the particular project, to all weigh in on whether the project is successful in elevating the human spirit and creating a place of beauty. And if they don't agree, then they're not going to be successful in that category. So just like you see a lot of buildings that might have won awards in architectural circles, but the public hates it, that particular project then wouldn't get this pedal. And to be a living building, to be a living piece of architecture, you with our program, you have to do everything in the system. So you have to do the net zero energy requirements, and you have to do the net zero water requirements, and you have to get the beauty requirements, etc. Because in life, nature doesn't pick and choose which of life's principles it's going to adhere to. It has to adhere to all of life's principles.
So, and talking about that, I'm curious about a couple of these. The water is one. And I'd like you to speak to that and how water feeds into.
Yeah, water is a huge issue globally, as you probably know.
Yes, right.
And it of course is an issue that is given attention in green building to various degrees, but we actually take an approach again that is much more holistic than any other program that is out there, where we are asking teams that are working on projects to understand what the carrying capacity of their place is. And that's an important concept that is forgotten in an age where we sort of get whatever we want from wherever we want it globally. And the notion of really understanding the uniqueness of a place and the resources of a place is fundamental to changing our relationship on the planet. So when it comes to water, what we're asking people to understand is, what are the water resources of the site? And shouldn't, for example, a building that was being built in Phoenix have a very different relationship to water than a building in Seattle?
Mm-hmm.
And of course it should be. It's intuitive. But that's not the way We design, our cities and the buildings within them these days. So what we actually have these project teams do is start with understanding the carrying capacity, the amount of water that can be harvested by the project, and that's all the water that they can use on the project. So if, for example, they're designing a building in the desert, it means they're going to have to build a building that essentially operates like a cactus, that holds water within, that doesn't waste water on frivolous uses, that uses water multiple times and treats the water internally.
So let me,
it's a very different paradigm.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, Jason. I just want to explain what that means. So let's talk about what that means for just a minute. So you build a home in a place that's more arid than where either you or I are at the moment. I'm living here in the east in outside of Baltimore, Maryland, lush rolling hills,
right.
More rain than Seattle, actually, just not as constantly. And you live in an area that is very rainy in a more constant fashion. So so what would it mean for a home to be built in West Texas or in New Mexico or Arizona or Southern California or Northern Mexico that would be different than what we would build in our two areas? Exactly.
Well,
what would it mean? What would it literally mean that it would do?
Well, it would mean a very different design and approach to water in all ways. So you wouldn't, for example, have landscaping on your property that requires water. You would be using local indigenous plants that are adapted to that place. It would mean that you would be harvesting and collecting as much water that does happen to fall throughout the year in a large cistern and treating that water for use. It would probably mean that you're using composting systems for toilets rather than flush systems. So you're dramatically lowering the amount of water that's even needed inside the building. And it also likely means that you're using gray water and matching the appropriate sort of level of treatment of water to the task at hand. So you're not using potable water that comes at a great cost for things that don't require potable uses. And so that gives you a range of things. There's often other things that one can do as well. But it's really changing the relationship to water. And what it's important to understand is it is possible to have a net zero water house or building in the desert. It's possible to have a net zero energy home or building in the cloudy Northwest. But it requires a different approach to design that goes much further in performance than what's typically possible. But the thing that is important for people to understand is that this is all very achievable with today's technologies, with the knowledge that we have. This is not a utopian vision of the future. We're actually right now building living buildings around the U.S. and Canada and starting now in 11 other countries with this program that are demonstrating that what we're talking about is highly achievable now, and the results are superior. They're better economically through time, and they're much more elegant in terms of their impact on the natural world.
And just one other one of your pedals I'd like to explore for a moment before we talk about some other aspects of what it means to have a living building or a living place, is equity. I found the equity notion really important because I think it has to do with, in part, from what I've read, about the exploitation of the people who build it and things related to that.
Yeah, there's the social dimension of a lot of these issues is something that hasn't been adequately explored by the green building movement. Even though it's an issue that people sort of acknowledge as important, really the green building movement has barely scratched the surface in understanding what are the best choices that we can make, not only for the planet, but for people, for community. And so these are questions that we're beginning to ask with our program. And when you think about what equity means in the context of our cities and how they're built and the buildings within them, you need to be concerned, of course, with what materials are used, where those materials come from, who is making those materials, the conditions that they were subjected to when they were making them. You also care about other aspects of equity that people sometimes don't think about. And it could be equity as it relates to full participation in the project by people of different socioeconomic classes. It could be that the building or project is being carefully considered from the standpoint of people that are challenged from a mobility standpoint, and ensuring that the build group of citizens. And as we, what's interesting is as we go international into other countries, because we have, again, projects emerging in other places, we bring these issues to those places as well, where they may not be as progressive in some ways as we are here in the States. In other ways, they may be ahead. And that's part of the goal of the program, is to elevate issues that are not being given proper attention. And issues of equity in how we design and build are significant areas that, that our industries, the design and construction sectors, need to be thinking more about.
So Jason, how does a building become certified? How do we know, at what point is it a certified building?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, because it's really important if you're going to call your project a living project that it actually performs as people say it's performing. And so we actually only certify projects after they've been occupied for a minimum of 12 months through a full year and four seasons. And then they have to go through an audit in person. We visit the structure. We look at, we need to see, you know, a great deal of proof, both documentation as well as the site visit. And only then, through all that scrutiny, would they be hopefully awarded the living building status. So that's an important distinction from many other programs, is the level of rigor that's required to actually get the certification.
Ain't easy.
No, it's not easy. The word challenge is deliberate.
One of the things that you mentioned earlier, when you said that there's a long-term economic gain from this building, from living buildings and creating things in this way, that, you know, oftentimes it seems that when we work at building things that are more sustainable, buildings, for example, and I love the description of buildings that you've been working on and building and creating. But is the cost of them initially, and how for some communities, for individuals, it's very hard to get to that place because of the cost of creating something that is in the long run sustainable.
Right, right. Well, I think it's instructive to look at the green building movement and how it's progressed over the last couple decades. And you mentioned LEED at the beginning of the conversation. And,
right.
And when LEED first came out, it was, you know, basically branded by a lot of people as something that would be prohibitively expensive and not practical in most applications, and all these different things were set. Within just a couple years, the initial cost premium of a LEED project dropped precipitously, where you now see LEED Gold projects with no upfront cost premium in many cases, and even Platinum projects, depending upon the project and who's working on it. And in general, across the spectrum of LEED buildings, we're seeing incremental first costs at 1% or 2%, minor upcharges relative to the benefits that are given economically to the project in terms of improved energy energy performance, reduced energy bills, reduced water bills, reduced maintenance and operations costs. So this happened in a very short amount of time. Now, what we're doing with the Living Building Challenge is we're saying we need to go further. And all of the projects in the Living Building Challenge have to meet, again, the requirements such as net zero energy and net zero water, so they're generating all their energy from the, you know, typically from the sun with renewable energy systems, et cetera. And these things do cost money to do. So living buildings are costing more up front than a conventional building, but they will never have an energy bill again. They will never have a water bill again. And what's interesting, as we have studied this and looked at projects that are emerging, is that the incremental first cost is not anywhere near as high as what people would have thought. And every living building that gets built makes the next one behind it cheaper to do, just like with the LEED paradigm. And so really this is about market transformation. It does make strong economic sense to do this, but it does cost a bit more up front, and you have to look at the whole sort of life cycle cost of a project to determine whether it's the right time for your organization to make the next step to the living level beyond LEED Platinum.
Well, take it from your own personal, from your own life. I mean, what I've read, you live in a house in Bainbridge Island that was built in the early 70s.
That's correct.
And so, and you are taking it slow on your own house.
Well, I'm doing. Well, I'm doing whatever I can when I can.
Right, exactly. That's what I mean. Right.
It wasn't a criticism.
It was just, you know, but the reality of what it takes ordinary human beings to convert their lives to a new life.
Yeah, and I run a nonprofit.
Right.
You know, the thing that I always tell people is, regardless of your budget, there's always something that you can do. There's always something you can do to improve performance, and from an energy standpoint, water or otherwise, and so begin it now. A lot of the things that improve performance don't cost any more up front.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a plan to do a living house for my family, and it's something that I'm thinking about. At the moment, my plan is to make the place where I am living as efficient as I can. And that's tough sometimes with a teenager in the house.
Yes, to say the least.
Yeah.
What I'm very interested in what you're describing, because what you're describing, and what it seems you're attempting to do to create living buildings or places for people to be part of.
Yeah.
You want to do one in every state. You want to do one in every province in Canada. You're trying to do things across the globe.
Yes.
So these buildings, are just make it succinct for our listeners, for people who are listening to this podcast, is that creating buildings that contribute to the environment, don't take from it, that don't need oil and gas, that don't need you to be attached to a septic tank or a water system, that live on their own. Is that really it?
It's a summary of where we're trying to move the industry, and we right now have approximately 100 projects worldwide in 11 countries. The bulk of them being in the U.S. and Canada, where we started, and we're focusing on pushing for as many of these. In many ways, they're pilot projects to a new future, and every city that gets a new living building in it opens up a whole new realm of possibilities for that particular market, because there's nothing like visiting something real and seeing the technologies in place and understanding that, hey, this isn't crazy, this is actually really cool. And there's nothing like, you know, the human spirit being what it is, where you can say, well, if my neighbor can do this, then I can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's actually what tends to happen. And so we're seeing in communities where living buildings are emerging that they're actually that almost like a halo effect. They're spurning additional living buildings in that community to emerge. So typically, when one emerges within a year, another one is being planned, which is really beautiful. And again, being able to visit, for example, in Seattle, there's an incredible project, the Bullitt Center, that's under construction right now, and it's a six-story commercial office building that uses composting toilets on every floor that will generate 100% of its energy on an annual basis from the photovoltaics on its roof, and that's it. This is a major Class A office building that will never have an energy bill, will use no fossil fuels, that will collect all of its water needs from the sky, and use composting toilets and meet all the other requirements of the challenge. And so this building is going to change people's mindsets about what is possible. It's in huge ways. The fact that you can do something like this in sunny Seattle
right.
is going to blow people's minds. And that's exactly what we're talking about, is that people don't understand the realm of what's possible and how far we can push sustainability in a very elegant fashion with today's technology.
I find this is fascinating. What I would love to be able to do, and I think most people listening would love to be able to do, is find the living building closest to them, to feel it, see it, to walk through it, to know it.
Right. Yep. And as more and more of these come online, they're going to be able to do that more easily. So we have about 100 projects in the pipeline. We've certified the first four projects. So right now there is a school in the Big Island of Hawaii that people can visit. There is a sewage treatment plant / community center in upstate New York that people can visit. There is a higher ed classroom in Missouri that they can visit. And there's a house on Vancouver Island near Victoria that they can visit. And this year we will be certifying several more of the first 100 to go through the system. So they're coming people's way.
Well, Jason McLennan, I look forward to talking to you more and to actually coming to visit one of these houses so we can get the world to start breathing this in and thinking about how we can make this a very different place.
Oh, it's good to be on the call.
Thank you so much.